Hello and welcome to Stepping Into Truth, the podcast where we talk about race, gender, and social justice. This is another episode that I recorded during the COVID-19 pandemic, and it's the final episode of season two. Today's conversation feels like the perfect way to close out the current season because I'm talking with someone whose job title I just love, and it's a title that all of us are thinking about. His title is Futurist. Chet W. Sisk is one of the world's most in-demand futurists. He's been talking about a shift that would change everything for the past 12 years. That moment is here. His work with companies like Visa, Blue Cross Blue Shield, the City of Denver, and activist organizations around the world gives him experience and insight on how to thrive and succeed in the new normal. His skill is making a big conversation small without dumbing it down. There are opportunities in the new normal, and Chet helps you and your organization identify them. So I'm really, really delighted to have Chet on the podcast. So Chet, thank you so much for being with me today. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
It is my pleasure to be here, and I am looking forward to it as well. It's that time where there are a lot of questions that are being asked, and it's a season for me, I can tell you that. So it's great.
I am sure it is. And actually, that's sort of the perfect way to start this, which is one of the things that made me so want to talk to you was just your job title and the idea of someone's job title being futurist is so intriguing to me, especially now when we know what the past looks like, but wondering about the future in a very different way for most people is very present right now. So I'd love for you to start us off by telling us what it means to you to be a futurist.
Absolutely. Actually, futurism, it's kind of a boring job in the sense that, you know, most people think about a futurist, they figure that you can look into a crystal ball and tell them, will I be happy? Will I be rich? Will I be pretty? Que sera, sera. I am not that guy. I'm not the guy that looks into crystal balls or read tarot. That's not a futurist. That's something else. A futurist really is a trend analyst. So all we do is look at trends and analyze data over extended periods of time. Now, me, I used to be a journalist, a television news and radio news journalist, and we used to follow news stories within the cycle. And then, you know, usually 24 to 48 hours, and then that story is gone because people's attention is just not that great. So people, it's usually gone. But a futurist is a person who follows a story way outside of the usual news cycle, years, just to see how those news stories will have an impact further down the road. So it's a different kind of gig. You have to have a lot of patience, but when you get a chance to present, sometimes you go into overload because you're trying to do all this data dump on an audience and you can't overwhelm them with data and facts and statistics. You got to break it down so that people can wrap their arms around it.
That's so cool, though. I mean, the idea of just looking far out into the future rather than the really sort of close-in view that most of us take. I mean, well, you know, when someone says, imagine your life 5 years down the road, for most people, that is almost impossible to do. It feels so very far away. And yet, in retrospect, 5 years goes by and we're like, oh, well, that was fast. what the heck happened here? So, yeah.
It is so true. Yeah, no, it's and so in a sense, what a true futurist's job is to help be that extra brain for most of us who work inside of really small time frames, you know, a year, maybe 6 months. But we're supposed to be the ones who sit back and say, this is what it looks like 5 years from now. I know you don't have time to look at the data, but here's what we're seeing. So you might want to prepare yourself accordingly. So I can appreciate the kind of world that most people live in. It really is quite short term, and it's becoming even more short term. So it's becoming even tougher for someone like me to get an audience. But at this particular time, I'm getting a lot of audiences and a lot of opportunities.
I would hope so, because I actually think that one of the things that's happening right now is we are being presented with the realities of a short time frame, and how that actually doesn't work out that well for us in a longer run. I mean, none of us is planning on being dead in 6 months. So looking further into the future can only be beneficial. I mean, obviously we can't figure out exactly what's going to happen, but when people like you can look at trends, it gives us information and we can make better decisions going forward with that information.
That's exactly right. And our job is not necessarily to be 100% accurate, because I always say trends are decisions that people make. And so that means people can change their minds, and they often do. Mm-hmm. But our real strength is in giving the big picture.
Yeah.
So I want people to understand that a futurist isn't the person that says, this is what's going to happen, point for point. A futurist is a person that says, this is what we see. And you'll have to make a decision based around this data.
So, cool.
Yeah, it's different. You know, you have to define that stuff earlier. Otherwise, people say, hey, didn't you predict? I'm not a predictor. I make suggestions.
Yeah, so you put your crystal ball away and are instead just using data. Oh, well, what are you going to do? So as we're having this conversation, we are in the middle of a global pandemic. And something you wrote really struck me. And that is, you wrote about the black swan. And you wrote about COVID-19 as a black swan event. Mm-hmm. And I would love for you to define what a black swan event is, and then talk about how we can use it to our advantage.
Absolutely. And let me just say that I'll put black swan with an asterisk by it. Now, for those who may not remember, there was a book that was out years ago called The Black Swan. And the author did a really good job of making sure that we understood that black swans are like, if you see a group of swans and they're all on the lake, they're usually white swans. And then every once in a while, something out of the blue occurs. A black swan will arise in the middle of all of those white swans. Now, the key is that you weren't expecting that black swan, because your mind was always geared to swans being white, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it is an unexpected event. So in a sense, that's exactly what COVID-19 is. And I say in a sense only because of the fact that there were predictions that something like this would occur for years. It's just when it occurred, I think, just caught us all off guard, and definitely caught our federal government off guard even more so. And so they are events that not only are unexpected, but they also change the landscape. They change everything. They're not just the one-offs. They actually affect our lives as we know them, such as the internet. The internet was not planned. It was not something that somebody said, oh, I'm going to go out and build the internet. It doesn't happen like that. It was something that was created from something else and became the internet, but it has changed our lives. So that's what black swan events are, something unexpected that really can change society, can change our personal lives, and change our futures. And so the COVID-19 event, like as I mentioned before, there were a lot of predictions around something like this occurring, mostly because of the fact that we had SARS and H1N1 before. So we knew that that potential existed out there. It was just a matter of when and where.
Yeah, and that's something that I think, you know, we know that there have been plans for pandemics. So obviously people were thinking ahead, and yet it's always a surprise when it actually happens. I think that's one of the interesting things about humans, is just the way we plan for something, and yet when it happens, we're still kind of surprised.
Still scratching our heads like, what happened?
Yeah, I actually think that's kind of charming about us, but you know, okay.
Yeah, there is a childlike charm about it all. Which
there is.
Yeah, and I think that means that we're not set, you know, we're not, you know, locked in. The element of surprise is always a powerful one. It could stem creativity and innovation and all of those things. So it's a good thing. Yes,
yeah, I agree. I like it. I like it. So something else that you've written about that I found interesting is you talk about caretaking leadership versus visionary leadership, and how these perspectives are on the opposite ends of a spectrum. And to me, it's really fascinating to think about how different the results of thinking in each of these ways are. And I had truthfully never really thought about it before. So if you want to give me a little more education on that, I would be thrilled.
Absolutely. First, let me just be clear about caretaking leadership, which is, there are a lot of people that will come in front of us and they'll say, you know, I'm here for change. But not really. What they're really talking about is kind of changing around the edges, that they'll do a little of this and a little of that, but they basically want to maintain the status quo. Now, you might hear me in this particular conversation with you that you might hear me lean into the whole idea that I think status quo is trouble. Mm-hmm. And I think that those who advocate for it, this is not their time. You actually really do need visionary leadership in a time of change. Status quo is just asking for problems. So there are those who are part of that status quo, that stationary kind of, let's do the best we can with what we got. But there is a time when you need someone to say, what's on the other side of this? How do we get there? What are the tools that are available? What are the creative ideas? What's the innovation necessary for this? And times of great change, of great distress, actually, they don't necessarily have to be times of change. It could be of great distress. Like if you're living in our society and you have climate crisis knocking at your door, you have income inequality that's worse than it was in the 1930s, when you have systemic racism and ongoing racism and all of these problems, all of those things. And I say this, and I have a new book coming out called You and the New Norm. And what I mentioned in it is that when you see a number of things that are happening, not just here in the States, but around the world, that are happening that are distressing, it's not necessarily like the end of the world, as people would say. It's an evolutionary step. All of these things are saying you have to do something else, and this is that evolutionary step. Stationary leaders are not the people to make that step. Visionary leaders are able to put all of that data together and are able to say, this is the next move we're going to have to make in order to navigate this, not just to thrive in it, but to succeed in this next step. And everybody can't see that, especially the stationary status quo folk. They just can't. And even more so, sometimes they are financially encouraged not to see it. That want to keep things going in their illusionary state. So
I was just about to go there. I was just about to say, so maybe they don't want to see these things. And I think that actually one of the things I've been noticing in this time of so much upheaval is there are those people who you see protesting in state houses or on the street or wherever. And I keep feeling like, don't they understand that, yes, this is really challenging for everyone and for some people far more than for others, but to just sort of dismiss what you're being told by scientists is not smart. You know, if people are struggling economically, which I completely understand, maybe the answer isn't to get mad at scientists. Maybe the answer is to get mad at your political leaders who are not making the accommodations that are necessary in this time. Yes. You know, instead of bailing out Boeing, how about you put money in the pockets of everyday people so that they don't feel this enormous financial pressure and they can do the things that scientists are saying we need to do to manage this crisis?
Yeah, you know? Here's the thing, though. When you bring up this conversation, you are called a progressive or a liberal or a, you can't even say Democrats anymore. I don't even know what the story with the Democrats are. But they look at it through a political lens.
Right.
Really what we're talking about is there are some real basics assumptions that we used to be able to make about humanity, that we should do everything we can for more people. We should not lie and steal and be a corrupt human being. We should look out for each other. Those were some basic tenets of an agreement, what I call a social agreement, that we kind of had in the back of our heads. And so when you talk about maybe we should make that money go from Boeing to more people, people get upset about that. And the only thing that you can think is they have given up on those basic social tenets, the ones that we used to agree to, that it is better to take care of more people than less.
Right.
And so we're now in this space where we've normalized the idea that only the few can should do well, and the rest of us are just the unwashed masses scrambling for a piece of meat and holding up our bowl and saying, please, sir, may I have more? I mean, that's where we are. And that's stunning to me.
It's so disheartening to me. But something that actually does give me some hope in this circumstance is that I think one of the things that's likely to come out of this whole experience is that we are going to get reconnected to our local communities, that hyperlocalization is going to become a more common thing as people have to rely more on the people immediately around them.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. Absolutely.
And I think that that offers us many possibilities for making change in ways that would not have happened otherwise.
Yes, yes. I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, you're speaking gospel here because there has to be, we have to go somewhere. And since we're realizing the challenges that exist, and I'm being kind here, the challenges that exist in our federal government, it not being able to distribute masks or tests or being able to oversee trillions of dollars, there's no oversight. And it just seems extremely problematic that we are going to have to find some vehicle, and the best vehicle, and I really lean heavily on this in the new book, is the whole aspect of community, of being able to organize networked communities that are able to trade and get advice to each other and be able to work with each other, even in the face of a failing, unfortunately, of bloated federal system. So yeah, you're going to have to find ways of doing that. And you're absolutely right that communities are there, they're available. We have social media vehicles, we have these kinds of vehicles, Zoom and such, that allows us to be able to connect easier and quicker. So yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's the way. And let me make sure that I emphasize this. Networked communities are the way. Because yes. You don't want the communities to devolve into fiefdoms. You want them to be able to connect with other communities, not just around the country, but around the world, in order to share resources, ideas, tools, whatever you need. And I do see that based around where the trends are going, that I see that as a distinct future for most of us.
That leads me to something that I came across when I was doing my research for this conversation. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this properly. Is it Ubuntu?
Ubuntu, yes, of course.
Yes. So Ubuntu socioeconomic construct. And I was fascinated when I read about that and went out and got it. Well, had a book sent home, did not go anywhere. And have started doing some reading about that. And I think that is something I'd love for you to speak about, because I think it really connects with what we were just talking about.
Absolutely. So there is a prevailing concept that exists out there in the world, primarily in Western thought, and that is some get, most don't. That's simplifying it, but it really is kind of a truth. Some get, most don't. That's why you have 1% having more overall wealth than the bottom 80 to 90% or whatever those numbers are. Mm-hmm. Because there's a prevailing belief that some get, but most don't. So I always say that once that becomes a belief, you start to create the policies, the laws, the infrastructure, and allocate resources in order to make that belief system come true, right?
Yeah.
So Ubuntu says there's enough for everyone, that we share these resources because all of us are connected. So now imagine that being the prevailing thought, the philosophy of the land, right? When you start thinking Ubuntu, it's a Southern African philosophy. And if you boil it down, it comes down to everyone and everything is connected. So all of us have value and meaning. So now you start creating laws that reflect that. So then you start to think about climate crisis, right? So now you're not thinking about the whole aspect of exploiting resources for your own gain, if you believe some get and most don't, but you start seeing it from the perspective of Ubuntu, and you start saying, well, the environment is just as valuable as I am. So how do I treat it that way? How do I treat another human being the same way that I do? It's a reflection of the old, you know, do unto others, golden rule, as it were. But in Southern Africa, they developed it into a kind of a philosophical construct that basically guided societies for hundreds of thousands of years until, of course, there was a kind of a Western approach that came to Southern Africa to kind of change that up. But that was, so it wasn't even a religion. It wasn't a religion. You didn't have to join a club. It was just the way that you thought about how things worked. So that, to me, is the belief that is necessary, that's agile enough, that's robust enough to be able to take us through change. If we embrace that as a concept that all of us are connected and all of us have value and meaning in all things, then we'll be able to tap the kinds of resources, other people's, other ideas, other concepts in order to navigate dramatic change. Now, understand, we're going to go through dramatic change, not just this year, but for the next few years. And the command and control some get most don't model is not strong enough. It's not effective enough. In fact, the only way that you can make that model work is through the barrel of a gun. And we don't want to see that. So what we need is something that is right for the time. And Ubuntu has the philosophical construct and the flexibility and the agility to be able to deal with the kinds of changes that we're going to see.
Yeah, I have to say that the more I've read about it, the more inspired I am by it. And it was used as part of the way that South Africa dealt with reconciliation after apartheid. And like anything else, it doesn't solve all problems, but it gives us a construct to live into that is a healthier construct, I believe, than the one that we've sort of kind of fallen into just without really thinking it through very well and without thinking about the broader implications. So yeah, it's fascinating. And I will put the word in the episode notes for this so that people have an opportunity to go out and do some research on their own.
Right. And let me just say that the book that I'm writing right now, You and the New Normal, really is talking about this period of time that we're in, to ask the questions about what is it that we believe? Because if we believe in some get, most don't, well, we see the results of that. What's happening right now, not only here in the States, but around the world, we are living the results of a some get, most don't philosophical construct that has been written into our hearts as a golden rule. And it is not a golden rule. It's just something that we've agreed on with over the past couple of centuries. So if it's that transient, then it can be changed. And so what I do is introduce the concept of Ubuntu simply because of the fact that it gives us another option other than the one that has led us to the brink of climate crisis, that's led us to the brink of social disruption like we've never seen before. Those are usual signs that perhaps that particular philosophical construct of some get, most don't, doesn't work very well. The de facto evidence is all around us. So that means nothing personal, but it's time to probably think about another philosophical construct that's better. And not just philosophy. I mean, in the things that we do, the companies that we create, the businesses that we construct, the communities that we put together, we are now in a time where we should be rethinking all of those things and asking the question, is this best? Are there better ways forward? That's all this is. That's the time that we're in right now. We get a chance to ask the question, put all the stuff on the table and ask what is best for this particular period of time.
I think that's agree more. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the only sort of good thing that can come out of this whole experience is if we actually look at our systems, we look at our structures, we look at what is working, what isn't working, and just start thinking about how do we want to do it differently? Because it is going to be different on the other side. I don't care what anybody says. Yep. Things are not going to look the same on the other side of this experience, whenever the other side is. And that might not be for a really long time. Yes. So if that is the truth, and I believe it is, then we can be intentional about what we're doing rather than just go along with whatever someone else wants us to do or someone else's impulse to try and get back to a normal that no longer really exists.
Yes. And that's why you have people like me, is that, you know, I have to tell you this story. There is a friend of mine told me this story. He was with someone else. I was invited to a party. It was a little celebration. And I was coming in the door and my friend was standing with the other guy. And the guy looked at him and he said, "Oh man, is that Chet Sisk coming in the door?" And the guy says, "Yeah, that's him." He's like, "Oh man, I don't even want to talk to that guy. I'm just here to get my party on. And I really don't want to hear him." And he says, why not? He says, "Oh, this guy's always talking about change and, you know, climate crisis and all this stuff." So, you know, people like me, we can get socially shunned because a lot of people don't necessarily want to deal with the kinds of changes. Change has been associated on the regular with loss. So even if you only have two crumbs, you figure that someone will take that one crumb, that's lost to you. And it's always someone taking something from you. But really what COVID-19 is saying is that there's a lot to gain from the kind of change that was forced upon us because we didn't want to go.
Yeah.
So we were dragged kicking and screaming into this level of change. And some of us are starting to find some of the gifts that this particular change brings. So people like me are the ones who go around and say, here are some of the gifts. You might not be able to see it right now, and you might be fearful, and people are gonna tell you all kinds of terrible things about change, about transformation. But the reality is that there are so many things to gain. And so people call me an optimist, but I'm a realist. I recognize that if we see and look on the other side and see the possibilities, we can start, like you mentioned, live from intention about what that next phase will look like, as opposed to letting it haphazardly happen to us. And that's what we've been doing for a while. So
yeah,
I'm the bearer of good news.
Okay, well, we'll go with that. And at the same time, I'm going to just say that a friend of mine is fond of saying that most people won't change until their backs are up against the wall so hard they're getting a rash.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That is the truth. And, you know, look, my job is not to force people to change. It's only to make sure that when they're at the place where the rash is so severe that they have to do something, that there will be the devices and the tools and the information they need. They'll be able to come back and say, "Hey, I remember that guy Chet was talking about this some time ago. Let me look him up." So that's my job, is because you can't force people to change. Then it becomes, I don't know what that is, but it doesn't work. No, it doesn't work. But it has to happen organically. But when people are ready to change, you'll have tools and ideas and something set in place so they know what to do, as opposed to just, you know, falling down in the night with nothing there.
Right.
So that's really a job of a futurist.
Well, yeah, it's so funny that, you know, we humans tend to like to think of ourselves, most of us, I believe, think of ourselves as fairly flexible, and yet the evidence really stands in stark contrast to that. And I think part of our discomfort in this time is that we are being pushed out of our comfort zones, and we're being confronted with so, not only so much change, but such a profound kind of change and so much loss. And someone I know who, he's Italian, he lives in Italy, so he was in lockdown for a long time under very, very harsh circumstances. Yeah, it's, you know, he said that death was all around, and that was hard enough to come to grips with, but that the really challenging thing for him was that he didn't see a road forward once the circumstance got better. And I think that that's where we really are struggling, is what is the road forward going to look like? And We don't know, but we actually get to make that road. If we do this right, we get to create the road.
Yes. Now, this goes back to what you were talking about earlier, about the difference between the stationary leader or the status quo leader and the visionary leader. It's the visionary leader and leaders and visionaries, period, are the ones that can best describe the potential of the road forward. And he's right that, unfortunately, I think that we've lost our gift of being visionary, that we have been in the industrial model where we're just plugged in and, you know, you go in, you put your 9-to-5 in, and then you go home and watch Netflix while you eat your burrito, has kind of taken away that visionary edge that we need. And so my personal feeling, I could be wrong on this, but as I look around and scan the environment, I do see a kind of a gap in visionary leadership. People can't envision anymore. Their best vision is about how to make more money. Mm-hmm. And that's not vision. That's just goal setting. Okay, if you want to make more money, I understand that. That's a good thing, but that's a goal. Visionary leadership means that you're talking about what does the next world look like, the one that we're entering right now, kicking and screaming. What does that look like? What do we want it to look like? What is it that we can intend? And then to gather the tools and the equipment, the resources that are necessary in order to make that intention more true. So it takes a little bit. I mean, it really does. You'd be surprised when you start to talk to people about their vision forward or their 5-year vision or something. They have 5-year goals, but it takes a little bit to talk about vision. I shouldn't say it like this, but visionary leadership is not necessarily the job of the guy who's trying to take care of his family and just pay his bills to get the stuff done because he's got enough on his plate.
Mm-hmm.
Those people, and she's working 2 jobs and she's got those babies back home. She's got enough on her plate. But the people who are supposedly in these positions of leadership, who are supposed to be looking out as a representative of those people, those are the ones who are supposed to be providing visionary leadership and make that vision so compelling that people are willing to do whatever it takes in order to make that vision possible. So their job is to support a vision that's articulated by the leaders. But the leaders have to have vision. If they don't have vision, there's nothing there.
You wrote something a couple of years ago about myth-making, Afrofuturism, and Black Panther.
Absolutely.
And I think that that's exactly sort of what you just said is about, and the reason that Black Panther struck such a chord for people was that it was visionary in so many respects. And so, I mean, I think that the power of myth and myth making as it connects to creating a healthy future is so profound. I mean, I love story. Story to me is so important because we have our stories of the past and we have our stories of the future, which people sometimes call dreams, but they really are. What do we want to see? I think that is something that if we could reconnect to that power, we would be in a much better place for visioning the future and understanding that it's not just about, oh, I want to have a boat in 5 years.
Yeah.
We would see that as maybe an outcome of something else, but something that's larger and more meaningful. So,
yes. Yeah. That article that I wrote about the Black Panther and about the whole aspect of the myth and how it captures the imagination and it gives us an opportunity to rethink who we are, that was my most read article I ever wrote. It was it viraled and did all kinds of things, mostly because I felt very strongly about how the movie basically captured and put in front of millions of people a vision of something that did not exist before.
Yes.
So that's the key to the what myth making really is. I was a fan of Joseph Campbell for a long time, up until I started realizing that he said some terrible things about Africa. And then a guy by the name of Ford, he wrote a book called Hero with the African Face. And he said that the essence of all myth making came from Africa. So to dismiss Africa as the myth making sources is like saying the ocean is not where water is. So that doesn't make any sense. But myth making in its essence, the storytelling, all of those things help us to expand our capacity. It helps us to redefine who we are in the world. It helps us to redefine the world. It helps us to make our associations with what we might call the divine or something bigger. And even more so, it helps us to be able to imagine possibilities when all we have is like drudgery. You know, you go to work, you eat, you come home, you watch Netflix, and you go to bed. Myth making allows us to expand above and beyond that and fuels our real world tools. So if there's anything that needs to happen, it is how we can make myth making and storytelling a regular part of our imaginative process, our innovation process, our creativity process. And you can't do that when you take arts out of the school or when you take arts away and then you limit it to all kinds of things. You have to bring those things back and help people to draw up their that resource, that tool that is absolutely necessary. I will say a society is dead if it does not have myth-making, storytelling, creative people who help us to imagine beyond the day-to-day.
Yeah, I really couldn't agree more with that. I was fortunate enough to spend time in Africa a few years back, and I was in Swaziland at this point, and there were these two little boys. They were probably 9 years old, and they were up in the mountains, and they were there with their cows. And I was walking by, and they were just playing as they kept an eye on their cows. But you could see, because they didn't have access to video games or things like that, how much they were using their imagination in just the way they were playing until they saw me. And then, of course, they got all shy and, you know, but it was so lovely. And I thought, this is so great. And I actually think that for American children, for a lot of American children right now, this is an opportunity for them. They are being thrown back on their own resources often in a way that hasn't happened since they were preschool.
Yep.
And they're getting to just use their imaginations, hopefully, and do things that they otherwise wouldn't have the time to do in our very structured world. And it's lovely. That piece, I mean, I feel for their parents. Yes, I do. Because being home with small children is, you know, 24/7 is not my idea of a good time. It's very hard.
Yeah, but hard.
You know, there is this piece that you get to see where their imaginations just spark and they do these really cool things. And I look at some of the things some of my friends' kids are doing and I think, that's amazing.
Yes.
That's amazing.
So the guy who's co-authoring my book with me, Dr. Mohamed Buheju, he and I spend a great deal of time talking about curiosity because we started realizing that curiosity or the really is an extension of imagination, that when you get outside of that which you know, that's where the real action is. I think there was an old phrase, no, it was a question that was given to Will Rogers some years ago. And they used to ask him, they said, hey, you know, he would say some pretty provocative things all the time. And they would say, you know, Will, why do you always go out on a limb? And he said, well, that's where the fruit is. And so that becomes our key too, is that in order for us to get that fruit, we have to get out there. And we think getting out there is getting, you know, that other car or material possessions, which I'm not against that. I think that those things can be good when in context. Absolutely. I encourage you to live your best life. But living your best life is not based around the material gains that you get. That's what we're discovering through this COVID pandemic, is that we're starting to realize, and not everybody, but there are people realizing the value of relationships, that not even thinking about them before, that a lot of people have gone back and recovered them, zoomed the people up and said, listen, I got time on my hands. I wanted to reconnect.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, all of these things that were not a part of our regular drudgery are now available to us. So this is a great time to do some imagination.
Yep. And we can only imagine things in the future. So Yes. Then we move into your territory in a really lovely way. Yeah. Well, our time is coming to an end, and I would love it if we could end this conversation. If you have suggestions for the listeners on things that they can do to just expand.
Absolutely. Number one, I would say, trailing off what we just talked about, you know, leverage this time to go call up friends and family. Me and my siblings were all, you know, we were probably regularly Zooming each other, Facebook Messenger for us. And we would just talk. I have four other siblings, so we get together and we just talk and catch up and check in about mom and such. But when the COVID pandemic hit, our conversations changed. It really started going to the whole aspect of checking in with each other and our health, and became deeper and more profound. So number one, I suggest that. Number two, whatever you can do to access some kind of meditative process that allows you to be able to calm the mind and hear your own thoughts. I firmly believe that. I'm a Buddhist, I believe in the tenets of Buddhism, but I do meditation and I call out to the ancestors, and it allows me to be able to quiet my mind and be in that state. And I think that that's a good thing, because we're not used to silence and quiet. We're used to things just going and blaring, electrical things and all that stuff. And then the third thing is that I highly suggest that you stay with me, because we are having, the new book is coming out next month. It's called You and the New Normal. And we kind of go through lifestyle stuff, what that means for jobs, belief, relationships, future pandemics. You can always find out more about me at www.chetsisk.com, and we'll keep you up to date on when the book will finally drop. But I feel very strongly about this one. Of all the books I've written, I feel very strongly about this one.
Well, I'm definitely going to get it. I have a feeling I'm still going to be in my apartment at that point. So, you know, there'll be plenty of time to read.
Well, and one more thing that we're going to really push the ebook version, so that you don't have to go out, you don't have to put hands on anything, because that is the new trend, is to make as little human contact as possible. So the whole aspect of having the ebook will be, you know, I mean, you're only talking about maybe $4 or $5 at most. So we're going to really push that availability.
That's fabulous. Thank you for making that accessible for more people at that price point. That's really great. Well, you know, I have to say, I have been looking forward to this conversation so much. And I'm just going to shout out to my friend, Anna Burrell, who connected the two of us, and she's amazing. And this has been such a pleasure for me. And I am really grateful that you were able to take the time and share your wisdom with us all. Thank you.
Thank you. And yes, I love Anna Burrell. I'm one of her biggest fans. I really am. And now I'm one of your biggest fans.
Oh, thank you. That's super sweet. I really appreciate that. And I will be staying in touch with you. And everybody out there, check out his website, chetsisk.com. It's really interesting, and his writing is really fascinating. And you've got time, so, you know, do this. So thank you again. And I hope to speak with you soon.
I look forward to it.
And thank you all for joining me for this episode. As the restrictions on us made necessary by the pandemic continue, we have the unique opportunity to look at what's been in our society and figure out what we might like to be in the future. What's working? What's not working? It's a lot easier to see these things from this vantage point and to make decisions with a wisdom that we might not previously have been able to access. So, as I said, this is our last episode for season 2. Keep an eye out for new episodes in July. And between now and then, do take a few moments, spend some time envisioning the future that you want to see unfold, and then take some tiny actions to move us closer to that future. From now till then, stay safe, stay healthy. See you in July.